This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
Now tell me about the Mexican UFO scene, because clearly there is one. If Jaime Maussan, is he kind of like the top dog of the scene, or what's the? Are there other people like in the field down there who are kind of like, geez, you know, what are you doing, man? I mean, like, so what's the tenor of this community of researchers and stuff?
To be perfectly honest, I don't follow the Mexican UFO scene that much. I actually, you know, don't even watch Mexican television anymore, you know what I mean? And so immersed with other stuff, so I don't even have time to watch TV. But there are a few people who are also involved, you know, like, for example, Ana Luisa Cid is a Mexican ufologist who has done some work, you know. She is also invited to some TV programs, you know, to speak about UFOs. And I think that she's been doing interesting work and researching some cases. You know, she was also trying to analytically overview the evidence presented by Maussan and his colleagues doing the Be Witness case. She talked to some people, I think an Egyptologist or someone, who confirmed that, you know, the body was a mummy and all that. So that's one name that I can say that is involved in Mexican ufology. There's also obviously, you know, some skeptics, you know, people who used to appear alongside Maussan in these old TV programs that I spoke of earlier in the show, you know, the Eustaquio Pina, you know. Canoon was very much like using the same guidelines as someone like this guy in American television, the guy with who used to be also very involved with UFOs.
Larry King?
Larry King, exactly. And you remember how King used to invite both the people like Stanton Friedman and also, you know, people.
Yeah, like, it would be the two sides. They would be like, hash it out on the show kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because in the end, you know, say, well, even if these guys don't present evidence, you know, what I want is ratings, you know, and what I want is drama, and I want to see debate and tension and confrontation, because that will be sell, you know, that will be good television, you know. So there's something of that. I know, and I guess there are still, you know, UFO devoted magazines out there selling in the newspapers, you know. I used to buy them, you know, in the early 2000s and all that.
Yeah.
You know, like regular magazines, you know, they are surely fading away.
Yeah, exactly. It's hard to find a regular magazine here. I think there's like a handful of, actually, I think, I don't even know if there's really any American magazines, left on this sort of stuff. You know, you almost have to get them from England, it seems, but I haven't really looked much lately. Now, beyond UFOs, obviously you've looked at a whole bunch of other stuff. Is there anything that really sort of, you know, if UFOs is your A number one topic, what's your B? What's your B-side? What's your sort of the other stuff that really, you know, piques your interest?
Well, I've always had a soft spot for Bigfoot and cryptozoology, you know. Right along when I was reading about UFOs in my early years, you know, I was also reading about Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster. I remember finding the book written by Tim Dinsdale, you know, the guy who recorded this film of this thing that is moving alongside the Loch Ness, you know, that has supposedly been analyzed by experts who conclude that it's a living thing or whatever, you know. So I read his book, and obviously, you know, when you're a child, you know, the romantic view of thinking that there is a living dinosaur, you know, living in this Scottish lake, you know, I mean, it's the coolest thing ever, you know, I mean, there is a reason why Jurassic Park and all those dinosaurs movies and all things dinosaur, you know, has such an appeal among the young audience, you know.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Kids love dinosaurs. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, there's something very atavic and very primordial to the idea of these monstrous beings that actually lived millions of years ago. And to the idea of this kind of a very Conan Doyle-esque lost world, you know, in Loch Ness or maybe in the Congo, you know, with this other cryptid, you know, the Mekele Mbembe, you know.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Do you remember that Disney movie, Baby?
A.D.?
No, Baby.
Oh, Baby. Baby. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. With it. Yeah, I do remember that. That was like when I was real young. Yeah, where they find, where they find like a little dinosaur down there, yeah.
Yeah, like a little dinosaur and all that. So obviously, now that you think about it, you know, the idea of the Mekele Mbembe is completely going against what we have now learned of dinosaurs, you know, now, because we used to think of dinosaurs as these sluggish reptile-like beings who needed to live in swamps because they were so heavy that their legs wouldn't be able to hold their weight down, you know. But now we know that that's not the case at all, you know, and now that we think that the beings like the Diplodocus and the Apatosaur and all that, you know, they live in more like arid-like environments, you know, more like forests than swamp-like jungles, you know. But
yeah,
we're still left with this idea that there are remote parts in the world where there might still be these living fossils, you know, who are still untouched by the hand of man. I have even considered the possibility that maybe the reason why cryptozoology had such a boost in the years 2000s and the like is because there is this like subconscious and psychological idea that we need to protect the ecosystem and these environments. Otherwise, you know, I mean, Bigfoot might go extinct, you know, and we even never managed to even discover it yet, right? You know, how many species are disappearing from the face of the earth, and we don't even know because we are just eradicating the rainforest in the Amazon in Brazil and whatever.
Right, that's an interesting perspective. I'd like to hear like Lauren's thoughts on that. If that's intriguing, because you wonder, cryptozoology did sort of explode like in the last like 10-15 years since like.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting too. Because you and I kind of have similar paths, and it's remarkable. I've talked about this where, you know, it's just funny how some mysteries, they're really big and then they die out, but they never get solved or anything, you know? Like Nessie used to be in like the top five mysteries, probably, I'd say, like in the 80s for sure, you know?
Yeah.
Now, like, no one talks about it anymore. It's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, really the idea of a living dinosaur, a living plesiosaur in these Scottish lakes, kind of completely improbable. Even though, you know, I still hold this kind of romantic fantasy that there may be some kind of underwater cavern system, channels that in which, you know, these creatures can go from the open sea, you know, and then return to the lake and maybe to mate and to nest and whatever, you know. But there's also the idea that how we used to have land sightings of Nessie, you know. There were a couple of people who actually reported the thing outside of the water.
Yeah.
When was the last time that someone claimed to have seen Nessie, you know, not in the lake, you know, so not some kind of hump, you know, that could be anything, you know, from a log or maybe, you know, the light reflecting on some wake of a boat, you know.
Right,
Actually, a moving thing, you know, right, blocking the road, you know.
Yeah, like flopping along in front of the car. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So what was that, you know? I mean, do we conclude that maybe the Nessie's habitat was, you know, kind of tampered or contaminated when they built the road coming from Inverness or whatever, you know, now the animals have adapted and they go to land very sparsely, or do we entertain more radical ideas that maybe the idea that Nessie is not really a flesh and blood being, you know, it's something more, well, here we go again, paranormal, you know, as much as we love the term, but there's really not many other words we can use in the language. You know, language is so limiting when it comes to this phenomenon.
Right. That's part of the problem, too, of trying to figure it all out, because you know, you struggle with the right words to describe all this and the right sort of, like, it's like that goes to sort of the problems with the ETH in a sense. It's like the only way to really understand this is you have to drape it on some kind of theory to keep going. You know what I'm saying? It's like,
yeah,
it's like you have to sort of place it into some kind of narrative in order for the human mind to try and figure it out. It's like you can't just completely be just like waving your arms around trying to figure it out. You need like I said, a narrative. So
yeah, that reminds me of the work of Jeffrey Kripal. I don't know if you have ever had him on the show, but
no, but the name sounds familiar. Yeah,
he has written some very great books. You know, one of my favorites is the one entitled "Mutants and Mystics." You know. And he came to the conclusion that these 14 phenomena are better understood from a narratively point of view than from an empirical point of view. I mean, because in the end, you know, we humans understand the world through stories. You know, that's the way we have always understand our lives and our environment. You know, stories that we shared and told around, gathered around the campfire, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago. And then maybe we ended up, you know, writing them in some kind of parchment or some kind of book, you know, and then that becomes a myth. And then the myth maybe becomes a religion or whatever. But that's right. The way we make sense of the world.
Exactly. Yeah. So when you're trying to make sense of something that's completely, you know, insane.
Yeah.
You have to come up with like a story to try and figure it all out, you know, or you don't really have to, but it's like we're compelled to, you know.
And we always will go back to our previous the things that are already part of our narrative and our language and our now like our information background, you know, like our cultural baggage, as it were, you know.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
I have always been fascinated by these ancient wood cuttings, you know, from the early European explorers who went to places like Africa and Australia and whatever, you know, and how they tried to describe things like a rhinoceros or a giraffe, you know. And you see those ancient wood cuttings and you say, you know, that thing doesn't look like a goddamn giraffe, you know.
But that,
they were trying to make sense of it, you know, from the things they knew, you know, the animals that existed in Europe, you know. And
right.
The way that they interpreted nature back in those days, you know, and that's kind of like the funky thing they come up with, you know, and that's like the best approximation they have back in those days, you know, and I'm sure the same will be said, you know, hundreds of years from now, that the way we try to interpret things like aliens, you know, and flying saucers, you know, it's interesting how the saucer started to progress, you know, from being very steampunk-like devices, you know, full of rivets and full
yeah,
of,
yeah,
you know,
like airships and stuff like that. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly, you know, and now there's these like sleek, almost like, you know, organic-like machines, you know, like the flying version of the T-1000, you know, in the Terminator movie, you know. And so now we're coming to things. Started to come with things like, you know, nanotechnology, you know, and AI and cybernetics, you know, those things inform also our understanding of the world, and maybe those things will start to influence the way we interpret paranormal phenomena.
Oh, I'm sure it's going to keep happening, you know, where it seems like the 100 years or so we've been looking at all this, it's always, the UFOs have always been one step ahead, so it'll be interesting to see what we see next. But it's also interesting, I find, too, that, I mean, you're on top of the news way better than I am. But it just seems like, I don't know, there's just, I'm going to use one of my favorite words, but the UFOs, they're just not titillating anymore. They're not doing anything, they're just not doing anything worth getting excited about anymore. I don't understand why that's happened, you know, and it can't all entirely be my cynicism. I'm sure that that's a... I'm sure that's a good part of it. I'm sure that is. But it's like, I don't know. The UFOs are doing the same thing they've always done. But it seems like, I don't know, people don't care. Or maybe the proliferation of cell phones and all that have made people even more cynical to, like, UFO news and UFO footage and UFO photos. But it just seems like the UFOs themselves have grown stagnant over the last, I don't even know, since the turn of the century.
Well, you know, maybe it's the effect of what our friend Greg calls UFO porn. You know, I mean, how many videos, you know, things, you know, hovering, you know, and sitting around can you see, you know,
right.
Say, well, you know, and how many stories of encounters with beings, you know, although those are still, you know, very interesting, but, close encounters of the first and the second kind, you know, there's a time when you reach a peak and you start to lose interest. And maybe you're right, you know, maybe the phenomenon has receded in a way, you know, from its interaction with the world, you know, maybe it's becoming more prevalent, but less dramatic.
Yeah, I think, go ahead.
Yeah, maybe it's because of the cell phones. I don't know. I'm not sure. Maybe it's because we have become more cynical or more accustomed to CGI, you know, and things like the Uncanny Valley, you know. We go and see films like Lord of the Rings and whatever. You see a goddamn dragon flying and belching smoke and fire, and you go like, oh, yeah, you know, kind of cool, you know. 20 years ago, I went to see Jurassic Park. The first time you see the tear, you're like, oh my God, you know. So now it's like, you know, oh yeah, whatever, you know.
Right, yeah. Well, that's interesting too, in a way, when you think about it, because I think you and I are in agreement that, like, this is a dance between the whatever the phenomena is and the witness.
Yeah, and definitely.
And it makes me wonder, I guess, that Maybe from a purely American perspective or a Western perspective, maybe it is like that. Maybe we've grown so accustomed to this idea of, like, you know, of seeing the fantastic. You know, we can now see such fantastic things that are created by computer that it's like, I don't know, it's damaged. I don't know if that's the right word, but it's altered the relationship between us and the phenomenon in a way that, you know, I don't know, it just has. You know, it's altered it in a way that which you and I are trying to figure out right now.
It has dulled our sense of the fantastic.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and that's kind of worrisome, you know, because it can be extrapolated to many other... many other things, you know. I mean, not just the paranormal, you know, the things that we have lost our sense of wonder. You know, I mean, right now, you know, just some hours ago, a spaceship that traversed I don't know how many millions of miles, you know, just had a flyby over Pluto.
Right.
I mean, over Pluto, goddammit, you know. I mean, I've seen the images and I've felt the wonder, but I would like to know how many people, you know, look at those photos and, you know, they actually manage to get a sense of wonder out of that before they go and try to see, you know, their next sting on Nine Gag or whatever.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because it's one of the few areas that I do feel like is kind of, I don't know. We do these year in review shows, and I sort of do the hot and the what's hot and what's not sort of as the year yeah. closes. And it's like, it does seem like sort of space has become really popular. And it does seem to be one of the few things that does generate that sense of wonder in people. You know, people genuinely, and it may just be because, you know, I have a very biased Facebook timeline, but it does seem like people generally have a sort of sense of wonder. I remember about the, you know, when they landed the Mars rover, people were really excited about it. It's like, so that there is that sense, I guess. That we can still do these, or even when they landed on the asteroid, you know, it's like that we can still yeah. do these amazing things. It's like one of the few areas where we can all sort of like get together and be like, damn, man, we landed on an asteroid. That's amazing. So.
Well, and by saying we, you know, we're saying, you know, our, technical mechanic emissaries, you know, because right now I'm seeing, you know, how more and more people are saying that this, you know, using rovers, you know, sending our telepresence to the universe is the only way we're going to experience outer space, you know? I mean, when you say, oh, when are we humans going to actually land on the surface of Mars or even go back to the moon? You know, there's one say, oh, well, you know, it's so difficult, you know, it's not really worth it, you know, it's going to be so expensive, and then people are going to have such a hard time, they're going to be exposed to so many dangers. No, let's just keep sending rovers. You know, that's kind of like, there's something there that, you know, that as a foreigner, you know, as a non-American, you know, I feel that Americans have lost their edge on space. You know, I mean, I don't know if you...
Absolutely. No, I agree. Well, they've ceded... feels like America has ceded space to corporations.
Yeah.
So, and we're in a transition stage right now where it's like, it took them forever, you know. I'm super hypercritical of NASA and everything for the reason kind of you said, where it's like, if you can get to the moon in 69, there's no reason why it should... why I don't even know how long it's been, you know, since we've been back to the moon, but it's well over 30 years. And it's like, there's no reason why we shouldn't have stayed. It makes no sense to me. So it's like, I'm super hypercritical of, you know, and I've had people who listen and they have all the reasons, and I've had guests on who sort of can explain it, but it's like, the explanation is just, they don't hold water to me. It doesn't make sense to me. It's like, so I think that's probably what's going on. You know, they've sort of ceded the control of space to these private industries, and maybe that's what will get people up into space eventually, back into space. You know, I think that if they attach a commercial value on it, once people sort of figure out that they can make money flying people to space, then maybe they'll be like, well, if I make X amount flying this dude into low Earth orbit, I could charge him 10 times as much or 100 times as much to take him to the fucking moon, you know? Yeah. And I can only hope that they do that, because I don't know what else, you know, I'm a huge advocate for just getting out of here, you know, get out of Earth, get somewhere else.
And maybe even staying in Earth, you know, because we know that sooner or later, we're going to have one of those big ass rocks coming from outer space that is really going to ruin our weekend plan.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's funny, you know, how to think about maybe what happens if tomorrow President Obama goes in a press conference and announces that NASA has detected a killer asteroid that is going to crash on Earth, you know, 5 years from now. And then what are we going to do about it? You know, I mean, Will we humans, the countries of the world, will be able to join forces, you know, forget their petty differences and start to try to come up with a plan that will be able to save us from the same fate that the dinosaurs, you know, went through. You know, I mean, I think Arthur C. Clarke was the one who said, you know, the reason the dinosaurs became extinct is because they didn't manage to develop a space program.
Well, that you talk to some people in the esoteric field, and they'll say that they did.
<You know? laughs> Oh, yeah, reptilians, yeah.
Yeah, those reptilians, yeah. That's the one part, I guess, about the whole reptilian thing that I do kind of like. It's a cool twist to the theory where it's like, you know, the dinosaurs didn't go extinct. They figured out how to leave because some of them were like reptile people. And it's like, what? Yeah. That's awesome. You see, because like you know, you were saying about Nessie, I think we're also kind of in agreement where it's like, I cheer for this stuff to all be true. I want all this stuff to be mm-hmm. true because it's like that would make the world such a better place for me. Not in any sort of way other than just like sheer delight. if Nessie was a dinosaur that was just floating around in Loch Ness and Bigfoot was like this giant hairy humanoid that's walking around, it's like that would make the world such a great place. So, but
yeah, well, you know, as with regards to Bigfoot, you know, I treat it as my own personal Schrodinger cryptid. You know, you know how the Schrodinger cat is either is both alive and dead, and it's not either one unless you take it out from the box. Mm-hmm. Well, unless someone takes Bigfoot out of the forest, you know, to me it's both a flesh and blood animal and a supernatural being.
Yeah, I've kind of come down on the side that it's like it is both in a sense. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I think I talked about this with Joshua Cutchin, where it's like, you hear all these stories about shapeshifters and stuff, and or just like things take on the form of animals, and it's like, well, if the Bigfoot's an animal, then whatever the supernatural things are that take on the form of animals would then in turn take on the form of Bigfoot also, not just a bear or a deer or something like that.
And also shows how we humans have debased nature so much that we don't think of animals as wonderful, you know, I mean, as supernatural beings in themselves, you know. I mean, that's one of the things that are so interesting with Mike Leland's research on owls. You know, I mean, he is researching owl sightings by people who claim to have the direct alien contact experience, you know, but these are real owls, you know, and say, well, okay, so it's a real owl, but still a supernatural event involving an animal. You know, why is it that we have forgotten the things that our ancestors kept telling us, you know, that, you know, animals have these powers and have this other aspect on themselves that we just don't see on them anymore. You know, we see them as biological machines the same way that we see ourselves as biological machines, you know, and that's that, you know. But maybe paranormal events are here to remind us that we are more than biological machines, and that the world is more than a chain set of chemical reactions and energetic, you know, processes that bring about, you know, things are pure, I don't know, mechanistic, you know, Newtonian kind of way.
Right. Well, we're at a crossroads in a sense, because it's, you wonder with science advance, with technology really is the ominous sort of cloud on the horizon. You know, it seems like more and more now, there's more articles all the time about how, you know, the robots are going to destroy us and everything. It's like kind of, it's almost getting scary now at this point, just because it's always, it seems like this recurring story lately, you know, that it's like, watch out for that technology. And it seems to me like this is inevitable. You know, I think as a species, we're going to just we're obsessed with creating our own demise, you know, and I think that's what's going to happen with alternate technology and everything. Maybe we'll merge with machine, but at that point, you know, are we even human anymore?
It's a question that I have pondered upon for a long, long time, you know, this idea of the singularity and the people, the transhumanist movement, and how they want to download their consciousness into some kind of computer, you know, so they can be immortal forever, right? But, well, maybe it will happen, or maybe it won't, you know. Maybe they will find that the hard problem of consciousness is not as easy to figure out as just trying to, you know, connect more neural networks in parallel, you know, just to try to process more information. You know, maybe there's something more, well, I don't want to say mysterious, you know, but something more to that than just, you know, seeing the human brain as just a computer, you know, because I am of the camp that the human brain is more of a receiver.
Right.
Than an actual, you know, the processor of consciousness, you know, and maybe the attempts to download or to create a strong AI will follow on the footsteps of people who were promising us gene therapies, you know, back in the 1990s, you know, where there was this the Human Genome Project. I don't know if you remember how. Yeah. They kept telling us that as soon as they figure out, you know, mapping the whole human genome, then we're going to have the cures for Alzheimer's, and they were going
right.
to have the cures for cancer and all that, you know. Well, 25 years later, we're still waiting. And what they found is that not only was the human genome a lot shorter than they actually expected, but, you know, there's not really a gene responsible for Alzheimer's. Or a single gene responsible for cancer. Hmm. It's a whole more complicated than that. And we're also learning that the epigenetics, you know, the behavior of your parents has a huge influence in your development. You know, something that 50 or 100 years ago, you want to say, dude, that is the theory of Lamarck. That is completely, you know, anti-scientific, you know, anti the things that we know about Darwinian evolution. But now, you know, there's like Lamarck 2.0, you know, epigenetics, the environment, and your parents, you know, and even, you know, your whole ancestry has a huge influence in how your genes activate, you know, how they switch on and off, you know. So maybe the same thing will happen with human consciousness.
Yeah, it's like the idea of like how the whole cryogenics thing, you know, how they're like, we'll freeze you, and then when they find a cure for being shot with a shotgun, we'll unfreeze you and take care of you.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, it doesn't work that way, man. Now we're close to the 2 hours. You want to go just a little bit over, just to sort of put a cap on things?
Yeah, let's go over.
All right, nice. I don't like to put people on this. I really should ask the guests like ahead of time, but I always do it. I feel bad. I'm waiting for the one time when the guests like, no, I said 2 hours and you get 2 hours. Wrap up your show, clown. But thankfully,
yeah,
everyone's been cool.
We are done.
Yeah. There we go. There we go. I keep losing my ringer here. You wouldn't believe the phone. I should take a picture of this phone that we use for the show and put it on Facebook or something. I'm talking, this thing is like from a time machine, man. It is, well, let me put this from Radio Shack. I don't even think there are Radio Shacks anymore.
Radio Shack, yeah.
So to sort of wrap up the live portion here, we got about seven and a half minutes. I mean, talk a little bit, plug some of the stuff where you write and, you know, what you're working on now and what you're kind of interested in and what might be next for you, you know, do sort of the plugs part of the show.
Okay. So as the listeners might know or not, I write for the Daily Grail. I put also a blog for Mysterious Universe and a few other sites. You know, Scotty Roberts used to have a blog for his Intrepid magazine, you know, and there were a few writers contributing for it, you know, and I was one of them, but in the end, you know, everybody bailed out and I was kind of like the only one left on that blog. But I still like putting my 2 cents on that particular page, you know, kind of like to write my more insightful or more philosophical pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the Daily Grail and Mysterious Universe, you know, I like to go the true Fortean path, you know, to write about everything and anything, not just UFOs, you know, also cryptozoology, also, you know, other mysteries, you know. The one thing that I'm more obsessed about right now is the whole thing about what we were just saying about consciousness, because I truly believe that consciousness has been the elephant in the room of all these mysteries, the thing that people in the UFO camp and even the cryptozoology camp and all those camps have neglected, and maybe it's the thing that connects everything together in ways that we are just starting to explore. And also the things that I'm really interested about is this new openness toward the benefits of psychedelics. You know, I'm very much in league with people like Graham Hancock, who think that it's the right of every conscious adult to try to explore their consciousness in any way they see fit. And if that involves using some kind of chemicals that grow naturally in the world, or even inside your own brain, like DMT, well, then so be it, you know. And maybe you don't want to go to the psychedelic route because not every path is meant for everybody. You know, there are many other ways in which you can try to expand your consciousness, you know, maybe using things like meditation or lucid dreaming, or other avenues that might help you see the folly of our materialistic the materialistic worldview we are immersed right now. You know, sometimes I really feel that the whole civilization is going to come into a complete head stop, and we are going to have to figure out another route in which we can as humans progress. You know, maybe the phenomenon itself, UFOs, are trying to give us a hand once in a while and trying to come up with, to pay attention and find another route. You know? So those are the things that I'm interested in. You know, maybe I'll try to become much more involved in the Porcian world. You know, I recently lost my day job, you know, and I'm trying to figure out whether I could actually go the full route, you know, as a full-time, quote-unquote, writer, even though I still feel I'm not a writer, you know, I feel like writer, you know, it's like you put things that are worth, you know, sacrificing a tree, you know, to make the poll for the paper that you are going to use for the book.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you know, I'm trying to still see where I can go and explore in this fascinating journey that has opened up in my life.
Nice. Well, I don't know if I would advise trying to make a go of it as a full-timer in this field. I tried for a few years, and I ended up in terrible debt. So, not a great path to take. But for some folks, it works, you know. And more power to them, and you know, good luck to them, you know. But to me, I found, and I'm sure the financial struggles had a lot to do with it. But I also did find that when I sort of was working, when the paranormal was more of a job for me, that it became less enjoyable.
Yeah, I exactly know what you mean.
Yeah. So, I noticed sort of later in life, you know, this was, I guess if we're going to sort of timeline it, we're talking like, you know, season 6, season 7 of the show. You know, but later in life, as I sort of got back on my financial feet, and really didn't need the money from the paranormal except just to pay for the costs of the show and everything, and sort of like living was paid for by working, then it became a lot more fun again. So
yeah,
I think there was definitely something to that, because it's, you know, when you have to sing for your supper, it becomes more and more like you kind of start to grow resentful of the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly. I know that it really becomes like a job, right? And it loses its allure, and from a fun hobby that you were willing to really devote your free time, now it really feel that you are committed to it, you know? Yeah, it loses some kind of spark, you know? I know that there are people who actually can make a living out of it, you know, like, well, or people like our friend Micah Hanks, you know, who has like 10 different jobs, you know, in order to make ends meet. And he, aside from his musical career, he has his writing career. And also that's an interesting way to go, you know, to have different pursuits and hobbies. You know, I think that having only one thing in which you devote your time, it's not the way in which Porcians should devote their time.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And it's like you talk about it, it's like you do, when it's a fun hobby in your free time, when it becomes your vocation, it's like then you, yeah. then you sort of fall into like an existential crisis in and of itself, where it's like, well, now what do you do with your free time?
Exactly.
You know, what's what becomes of the free time? Well, yeah. Speaking of time, that's a good segue, because the British lady, which only Red Pill Junkie and I can hear, she's informed me that we're closing in on the final moments here of the live program. So I want to thank all the folks who tuned in to the live show. Thank you, of course, to Red Pill Junkie. We're going to keep chatting in a few moments as we close out the program. But again, big thanks to the folks in the chat room. Big thanks to the folks who tuned in live. And if you are the folks who tuned in live, grab the MP3 in a couple days, because there'll be some additional conversation on there as well. And, you know, check out Red Pill Junkie stuff. He's on Facebook, so punch in Red Pill Junkie and like him on there, folks, because you don't have a web hub or anything yet, right?
No, I'm thinking about having one. No, not right. Not right now.
Hmm?
That I'm thinking about getting a domain, you know, kind of like a central hub for things, for my many pursuits, you know, not just the writing, but maybe also other business ideas I'm trying to come up with. But right now, you know, I'm glad of being, you know, like the fly on the wall of many websites, you know.
Yeah,
among
yeah.
those, you know, the Daily Grail and the Studios Universe.
Nice, nice. Well, there, oh, geez. I don't know if I should even, I don't know, is this safe to mention? Let me see. Yeah. Well, apparently there is someone already has redpilljunkie.com, so.
Ah, yeah, I know. there's a guy who uses the handle Red Pill Junkie on Twitter. You know, it's kind of like a drag. And this is an interesting thing. You know, I actually tried to investigate the guy, and he is a Mexican also, and he is also an industrial designer. You know, which is the thing that I studied in college. So
oh, wow.
Talk about a doppelganger.
Yeah, that's weird. That's weird. Well, there's a lot of weirdness going on, actually. We should mention this, because I thought it was really interesting, and the more I thought about it, the more interesting it sort of became, because it's like so, you know, let's, you know, we talked about this. I'm super cynical. I think, like, almost everything is bullshit, so it's like, all right. But this is amazing to me. Like I said, the more I think about it, the more amazing it gets, because it's true. It really happened. You have a word of the day app on your phone, and the word of the day for today, which is when we're going to talk, was foison, which is like, that is such an obscure word and so esoteric. You know, it's connected to the whole thing that we talked about with Joshua Cutchin. It's really amazing in a lot of ways that would
what,
come up. It's you know, it's almost undeniably weird. You know, it's like
was Joshua
really.
Your last live show?
Joshua was the last live show, yeah.
Wow. Well, there you go.
Yeah. So it's like the universe is like, fire it up, man. Get some foison out there. So, yeah that's just so weird. Because like I said, I mean, I'm sure there's people out there who say, oh, it's all random and everything. But it's like, that's just beyond, you know, random. To me, it seems like it has to be some kind of like poke in the synchronicity, you know, realm.
Yeah, I mean, synchronicity is the way in which these phenomena manifest more openly in my life. You know, I mean, the first time I started to have one of these really, really meaningful synchronicities, you know, it was, you know, really mind changing for me. You know, and I think the same thing happened to someone like Jacques Vallée, you know, a guy who has spent all this time researching about UFOs, and to my knowledge, I think the guy has never had a UFO sighting. You know, I really also haven't had anything, you know, dramatic, you know. When
yeah, me neither. Yeah.
Sightings, you know. But I have had a lot of interesting synchronicities. And with him, you know, this is something that he wrote about in his book, Messengers of Deception, which to me is one of the top five books any people interested in the 4GM world should ever read. You know, he started to see how synchronicities could be, in a way, connected to this phenomena, and also could hint to the idea that consciousness and information are the two building blocks of reality, which in itself, you know, it's like such a mind-blowing and radical even heretical, you know, idea nowadays, you know, but I keep coming back to it, you know, and I really think as time progresses that that really is it, you know, that consciousness and information are more fundamental than energy and time space.
Hmm. Right. Well, it makes you wonder if they're even ever going to be able to figure out consciousness, because it's been around forever and they still can't seem to get a grip on it.
Yeah, maybe we will never do it, and maybe that isn't such a bad thing, because imagine life without mystery. You know, we'd be so goddamn dull. I think that I remember this thing that Whitley Strieber, you know, the famous abductee, you know, the guy who wrote Communion and all those very important books. I mean, he practically brought the meme of the alien rectal probe to the mainstream, you know, much to his chagrin, nevertheless. But
yeah.
Anyway, I think that he wrote in one of his blogs in Unknown Country, I think that's the name of his website, how he once projected on his image this question that he wanted to ask to the visitors, you know, the way he talks about them, you know, about he wanted to know how they viewed the universe. And the response he got was an image of a closed coffin, you know.
Hmm.
So I guess the idea is these entities, they have lived for so long, or they have traveled the whole of the universe of this reality, or how many realities they there is nothing else to figure out for them, you know. There is no mystery left. So in that way, there is nothing more to get excited, getting back to the cynical idea, you know, then the universe becomes like a trap, you know. And maybe that is the reason why the phenomenon is so interested in interacting with us, because in a way, maybe we inject novelty into their existence, you know, being like the new kids on the block from a cosmological point of view, you know, maybe it's something similar to what parents experience when they have children, you know, and they young children, the first time they see, I don't know, snow, their first Christmas, the first time
exactly,
they get a Christmas tree, or they you know, the first time they have a birthday party, you know. The parents, they enjoy it kind of like by proxy, because they can get to relive it in the eyes of their children. Although you could also say that you could also view it in a more negative kind of way, you know, when you see people like Hugh Hefner, you know, the guy with the editor of Playboy, you know, and the guy is marrying women that are like 50 years younger than him, you know.
Right, right.
And in a way, he's trying to keep young by being surrounded by these young women, and he's becoming like some sort of vampire, you know. So it's the open idea, you know, which one is it? Are these visitors, you know, being like benevolent parents, which are trying to help us in our development, or are they some kind of demonic vampires that are trying to prey on us, feed on us, or feed on our naivete?
Right, yeah. Well, you presume that it's like a whole mix of stuff. That might be part of the problem, too, of trying to figure it all out. It's like people are, you know, you're always sort of like, you're always trying to put it in a box of good or bad or indifferent.
Yeah,
it's like, there's probably many different things going on. You know,
it
ties into the sort of the idea, too, that it's like, you know, I still sort of like keep the ETH on life support. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's a valid idea.
Right, exactly. It's a valid idea. So it's like, I'm not completely, you know, I'm not one of those people that's like, it's bullshit. It's, you know, it's like, we don't know. So we can't say it's absolutely that, and we can't say that it's absolutely not that. But I guess the point I'm trying to make connecting to your thought was that, you know, it always sort of like brings me back to the scary sort of idea that conspiracy folks tie into ufology and UFOs and aliens and everything, where it's like we're property, we're like at the center of a battle between forces much bigger than us. It's like that very well may be the case, that there's a whole bunch of conflicting forces at work. And, you know, for all we know, we talk about sort of like how it seems like the UFOs have gotten stagnant and maybe there's less interaction. And it's just like maybe, you know, maybe some other race of aliens got custody of Earth. And so that's why things seem to have changed. Who knows?
Yeah, no, maybe, you know, there's the famous Fermi paradox, right? You know, Enrico Fermi, this physicist who said, you know, okay, so there clearly has to be life in other parts of the universe, so where are they, right? So there have many ways to try to solve the Fermi paradox, and what's interesting about it is that the solutions inform us more about our current thinking than about what really might be going on, you know? So they used to say, well, you know, distances between stars are so ginormous that it's impossible to travel, you know, to another star system, you know, because it takes like forever, you know, and it takes a lot of energy. Maybe there's the people who favor the ATH, they are always fond of speculating that maybe there are ways to circumvent that, you know, maybe through wormholes or whatever, under this the famous Alcubierre space rod, you know, this like kind of like a Star Trek engine that could might help us to develop a faster than light spaceship. You know, there's this idea, and then maybe there's the other idea that, you know, well, maybe there's some kind of a cataclysmic event that happens and that prevents intelligent civilizations to develop beyond a certain threshold, you know, or maybe there's some kind of cosmological bullies, you know, that go and like to snuff out, you know, nascent civilization just when start to creep out, you know, some kind of like Galactus, you know, kind of like entity who goes and consume worlds before they manage to escape, you know. I've always been fond of the idea of the solution to the Fermi paradox, to the idea that, yeah, maybe we are inside some kind of galactic zoo or galactic, maybe like an aquarium, you know, and maybe, yeah, you know, now the idea comes, you know, are we in the hands of a responsible aquarium hobbyist, you know, or are we, you know, in like in the bowl of a 10-year-old, you know, child who just got a goldfish, you know, from some kind of fair, you know, and then, you know,
yeah,
next thing you know, the poor thing is belly up.
Exactly, yeah. Well, what you're saying reminded me of something I heard about, so we're getting back to that AI thing, where it's like one sort of idea is that being subsumed by technology is sort of like that next step of the evolution. You know what I mean? Where you're saying, like, maybe it's a thing where, you know, you blow yourselves up before you can get out there. Maybe it's a thing actually where you're just where you end up creating technology to the point where the technology like outdistances you and goes on without you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's entirely a possibility too.
Where it's,
you know, that might have been what happened to some of these species. Maybe that's why they're coming back here, you know, if they are, because they're like, don't be careful what you do, because next thing you know, you're all going to be connected to spaceships and you're not going to like it or something.
Yeah. There's this other idea that has become more popular in the last years. The idea that, you know, an advanced civilization develops virtual reality, you know, and they create artificial worlds that are more engaging and much more interesting than the real world. And instead of just going and explore outer space, you know, all these beings decide to go and live inside their own fantasy world, you know. And so these guys, like these aliens, are like spending the whole of their lifetime, you know, like playing their version of World of Warcraft, you know, instead of, you know, go and colonizing worlds, you know, in other solar systems, you know. And but like I said, these ideas are a reflection of our own fears and our own bias towards technology. Now we're seeing how, I mean, maybe in 10 or 15 years, we're going to have in every household our own version of the holodeck or our own version of the Oculus Rift.
Right.
What is that going to do to our society? You know, when you go and instead of, you know, watching television, you can go and jack in like in the Matrix, you know, and go and have a date with, I don't know, Farrah Fawcett or whatever.
That would be pretty nice. Yeah. Well, it's,
maybe.
Yeah. Well, I get what you're saying in a way too. It's like, we already do have people that are spending their lives on World of Warcraft. That's already happened to us.
Yeah,
and,
I mean,
and maybe at the expense of us exploring other worlds, you know, it may already be happening here.
Yeah, I can't criticize anyone who likes to play RPG games. You know, I'm a big gamer myself, and I like devote most of my time now online. You know, I mean, with the Twitter and with the blogging, and now that I decided to take the goddamn blue pill and on Facebook, you know, I might as well glue my tablet right on my forehead, you know, and forget about all that's happening in mid-space, you know.
Yeah.
But in a way, you know, it's also interesting how there are more and more scientists who are really entertaining the possibility that the whole universe is a simulation.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I've heard that whole theory. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of like harking back to what I was saying, you know, that, well, it kind of like the old becomes new again, because all these ideas are nothing but reiterations of the whole Platonic thing with the cave, you know, and the, you know, the projections on the wall on the cave, you know, and the implicate order and all that. So maybe, yeah, maybe we are living in a kind of like a world of shadows, you know, some kind of holographic subset of some super geometry, using the term coined by Tom Fusco. You know, I don't know if you have had Tom on the show.
Yes, I've had Tom on. Yep.
Okay, so yeah, I think that his ideas about the super geometry, you know, are very relevant to the discussion of the paranormal phenomenon and even the UFO phenomenon.
Hmm. Hmm. Trying to think what else, what other avenues we may go down here tonight on the show. This has been a remarkable conversation, RPJ. So what, now,
yeah.
I didn't press you on this at the beginning of the show, but now we've gone for a while, so we can kind of cut loose a little bit here. So you kind of talked a little bit about the origin of the name Red Pill Junkie, but what, I guess, why, and believe me, this is not a critique. If I could go back and do it all again, I would use a completely different name
because
<Yeah. laughs> it seems advisable. So you went down the right direction, but I guess is there sort of like a reason that you still use just the nom de plume, or Red Pill Junkie, or is it sort of, you know, what's the story behind all that?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I don't really remember how I came up with the such a oxymoronic term, because it really is an oxymoron if you think about it, you know, because in the end, the idea behind the Matrix is you have to take the red pill only once, you know, but in the same, you know, it kind of, to me, it's not in a nice way of saying how, you know, that's not really true, you know, you really have to be taking the red pill, you know, all these things that I see as the red pill, you know, these things that I find all the time questioning my reality, but you need to keep doing it all over and over again.
Yeah.
And then I was using the term Red Pill Junkie as in the comment section of some web page, and then I used to use the same nickname in other pages, so two people will recognize me and say, oh, so this is the same Red Pill Junkie who commented on that other thing in that other website. And I'm not the only person who does that. You know, there are other, like, super commenters, I will call them, you know, on the web in the paranormal scene, who also use the same nickname over and over again. There's this guy, like, Kandinsky, you know, there's also Terry the Sensor, Poor Old Girl. You know, there are these guys who really like their nickname, and they use it in every website they visit, you know, and I did the same thing, you know. And then that's the name that I decided to use on the Daily Grail, you know, and then kind of like decided to keep it, you know.
Yeah.
In the end, I think that it was kind of an interesting way to try to be more, I don't know, enigmatic and crap, you know,
try
to have a more of an allure, you know, and also try to maintain some level of anonymity on the web, you know, even though that by now everybody know that my real name is Miguel Romero, you know, I've mentioned it a couple of times, and I don't mind saying it, you know.
Because, oh my God, you know, this is like El Santo unmasking.
No. You know, Gene Steinberg on the podcast forced me, you know, to say, you know, I want you to say, I don't know, I think that the Gene has a real problem with the term junkie, you know, maybe because of the negative connotation it kind of the world has on our culture, you know.
But,
you know, another thing I really like about the nickname Gene is that it reminds me never ever to take myself too seriously.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because it's so whimsical, some kind of nonsensical, you know. It forces me to remain in that kind of like, you know, whimsical, tricksterish, you know, playful level, you know. If I try to, you know, then feel like I am the all or be all and, you know, like the big fish in the pond, I think that's the moment that I will really start to lose, you know, whatever insights I have might have had gained, you know, all these years, you know. So I like the idea, you know, that not taking myself too seriously, people not taking myself too seriously, the same way that maybe the phenomenon itself shouldn't be taking it too seriously, you know. Do you remember that famous UFO case with this police officer, you know, this guy, I think his last name was Shermer. I was talking to Greg the other day about this, you know. That was one of my favorite UFO close encounters of all time, you know. The guy who gets aboard the UFO ship, you know, with these beings who have like cat-like eyes, you know. And in the end, one of them says to him, you know, we want you to believe in us, but not too much.
Hmm.
I think that's kind of like the right approach to this phenomenon. Because
absolutely,
otherwise
yeah.
you become obsessed, and that's not a good thing. That's not a good place to go.
Absolutely. I'm in total agreement with you there. It's like, you can't take this stuff too seriously. I worry about the people that do, because it's like, they exist in a world where their worldview is completely off of what the shared worldview is. And it's like, you have to at least be able to understand the perspective of the remaining, the rest of the population, that what you believe in is crazy. Like, to people that are, you know, out there that are just absolute ardent believers in all this, sometimes they can really go off the deep end where they just, you know, they take it so seriously that, again, it shapes their whole worldview. And it's like, oh man, you're not existing in with the rest of us, and that's worrying.
Yeah, and they should ask themselves, you know, what is this obsession bringing to my life? Is it bringing me knowledge? Is it bringing me joy? Or is it bringing me, you know, sorrow? And is it bringing me despair and paranoia? Paranoia, because if it's the latter, well, maybe, you know, you should consider quitting.
Yeah, that's that's sound advice for sure, because it can be troubling for some folks. It can be tough. But like I said earlier in the conversation here, you know, and you sort of touched on it just now when we were talking about the name. It's like, I really do appreciate the sense of whimsy and wonder that you produce in your stuff, and the sort of sly sense of humor. Even in the emails just between you and I, they have that sort of quality, which I really do appreciate. It's nice to have somebody who kind of, who like our mutual friend Greg, doesn't take us all too seriously, because,
exactly.
You know, it's, I don't know if it's supposed to be fun, but I think it should be fun. That might be the best way to put it, you know?
Yeah, I think that having a sense of humor is a good tool, you know, to keeping your feet on the ground in this field. I also feel, you know, that, that the phenomenon itself, you know, has a very, very clear sense of humor, you know, when it interacts with us. You know, I mean, one of my favorite cases of all time is the one in happened in the former Soviet Union in 1981 in the city of Voronezh. You know, there was this time when these kids were playing in some park, and then this like sphere-like object, you know, landed, and out of it came these like giants with three eyes. You know, it's such a, you know, bizarre and absurd story. You know, even though there are many reasons to believe that it's genuine, but one of the things that really flies in the face of it is the fact that in the belt buckles of the beings, you know, and also in the drawings of the child witnesses, you know, there is this symbol that has been acknowledged or equated with a very notorious fraud in the UFO field, you know, that is the UMO symbol, you know, that is was part of this letter that was supposedly sent to several people in Europe in the 1960s and 70s,
yep,
you know,
yep.
Which was supposedly sent by alien beings coming from the planet UMO, you know, and after that, you know, many people think that the whole thing was a hoax, you know, maybe perpetrated even by the CIA or the KGB or whatever. But the end is that in all likelihood, you know, the letters were a hoax. But now we have this new, what seems to be a very compelling case, you know, and what? It has like this phony symbol, you know, right on top of it, you know, like some kind of like in your face, you know, way of like showing us like the middle finger, you know, it's like
yeah.
It's part of the self-negating nature of the phenomenon, you know, like saying, you know, yeah, you're never going to figure this out, guys. So, you know, keep trying though, you know.
Right. Well, that's what we're going to have to do. Man, let's just keep trying to figure this out, or at least find the stuff that interests us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I do, and I know that's what you do, you know, with
mm-hmm.
your work. So, and I gotta say, dude, like I said at the very beginning, you're one of the good guys. I really do. You dropped some profound thoughts on us tonight, and I really do appreciate
thanks.
It. You know, and what I also like is you're not just out there everywhere, which is which is nice, you know. It's refreshing. So. And we have a mutual friend, Brent Swanser, so.
Oh, yeah, Brent is, you know, one of the rising stars in the fortune field. And I really feel that the guy is going to go places, you know. I was one of his fans back when he was writing for Crypto Mundo, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Yeah,
he
me too.
Saying, wow, this mystery man guy, you know, he's deep, you know, he's really, really knowledgeable. He really knows his stuff, you know, when it comes to cryptozoology and biology and all that, you know. And then we kind of like regained touch via email, and then I saw him, you know, starting to write for Mysterious Universe and all that, you know. Now then I remember when you were starting to ask me, you know, oh, how can I get a hold of him, you know. And then I remember him, but I hope he doesn't mind disclosing this, you know, how he was really nervous, you know, he was really not sure whether he will be willing to go to your show or any show for that matter, you know. And I was like trying to convince him, you know, dude, you will be fine, you will be great, you know, do it, you know, just, it will be, it won't be, you know, it won't suck. You
yeah,
know? Then,
no,
you
he
know?
Did great. He was awesome. And it's like, he
yeah.
deserves all the, you know, that's why when I, you know, I remember after we posted the show, it was like I emailed you right away about it. And it was like, you know, I'm all for like promoting my show and everything. And I'm happy
yeah,
to send out emails and everything to sites when we post a show. But this time there was like a different sort of mood on my end as far as getting the word out about it, where it was like, we need to celebrate this guy. Like,
yeah.
you know, so and the same goes for you, man. I mean, you do some tremendous work, and And, you know, that's kind of why I wanted to have you on the show, beyond the fact that we were way overdue to have you on the show. But it's like, I want to celebrate the people that do good work. You know, I may sound cynical on the show, but I recognize that there's a lot of good stuff out there, and the people that are doing good stuff should have a platform to talk about it and be celebrated. So guys like you and Brent, I'm happy to have on the program like anytime, because you're doing good work.
Getting back to what you were saying earlier, how this field is not really the avenue to make a profit. If you're really thinking of trying to make a buck, stay away from UFOs, guys. But having said that, if what you want is a different kind of wealth, the wealth of getting to know and befriend really, really interesting people, who have a lot of knowledge and a lot of interesting fields, not only UFOs, but many other areas, and that's, I can't recommend this field highly enough, that it has really made me rich in friendship with people like you, like Greg Bishop, Brent Swanser, Joshua Cochin, my cosmic compadre, Micah Hanks, If you are pursuing that kind of fortune, then this is the right field for it.
Absolutely, yeah. You'll make some great friends, and you'll learn a lot about it. You may not learn much about UFOs, that is for sure, but you'll learn a lot about people, I guess. That's the point. You'll learn a lot about the human condition in a way, and what makes people tick and that kind of thing, it's more probably than you will about UFOs. So it's a strange sort of learning experience.
Yeah, you learn about people and the world, and that's not such a bad second prize, maybe, that's the reason why these entities keep coming back, maybe they have traveled all around the world, and in the end, this is the most interesting place to be,
That would be pretty awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll wrap it up here. Do you mind just stay on the line? I'm going to do the plugs. That takes like two minutes, and then we'll just kind of do a little off air after chat. You don't mind, right?
No, not at all.
Awesome. You're the man. I really appreciate it. I appreciate you coming on the show here, man, and giving us the extra time and really just opening up and talking about all kinds of stuff. I really enjoyed the conversation. I really, really did. I don't know. We're on a real hot streak here, because it seems like every show we've done this year so far has been just really, really good. And we kept it up here with this program. And I'm sorry it took us so long to put it all together, but I'm really glad that we finally did. And like I said, you should be celebrated for doing some really amazing stuff, man. And thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you, man. And I'm sure that this will not be the only time that we'll get to once again talk about all these things on the Null of America. I'm looking forward for my second appearance, which hopefully will not take as much as long as this one.
I promise you it will not. All right. And folks, check out his stuff at Daily Grail and Mysterious Universe, and punch in Red Pill Junkie on Facebook. That's where you can find him and like him and follow his stuff. That's a good hub to get the latest on Red Pill Junkie. I'm trying to get Brent to hurry up and get on at least a page like that so people can find him.
Yeah, I know. I told him to.
Yeah. All right, folks. Well, this is the plugs portion of the program here, where I tell you a little bit about the program. If you're a first-time listener, if you're just listening via Blog Talk, you're probably absolutely completely confused because you've missed the last five episodes because we just posted them at Banal of America. So on that note, do not subscribe via Blog Talk. Just go right to Banal of America, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com. That is the website. We're also on Facebook, much like Red Pill Junkie. Just punch in Banal of America on Facebook. Head on over to BOA if you want more BOA audio. Tons of stuff on there. 200 plus episodes in the archive. And of course, it is all absolutely free. And I should mention that we are on the TuneIn Radio app. We finally have taken a tiny step into the 21st century, because now we're on this TuneIn Radio app. But I don't know anything about it, so don't ask me for technical help, folks, because I'm on the Radio Shack phone. I mean, come on. So tune in, tune in radio app. We're on that, and I think we're going to try and get on Stitcher soon, but it got away from me. But if people want us on other apps, let me know, and we'll plug them into those apps. And as I said, 200-plus episodes in the archive, all absolutely free. And we do that via donations from the Banal of America listeners. How do you do that? That's simple. Head on over to PayPal, or head on over to Banal of America. That's where you can click the PayPal button. That'll bring you to PayPal. They will walk you through the process. It's safe, secure, and simple. But if you don't trust the internet and you want to make a snail mail donation, there's also a P.O. Box address that you can also find at Banal of America. I cannot stress this enough, folks. This is our fifth international episode in a row. It's been really a remarkable undertaking, and I'm surprised that it worked out so well. As I said at the beginning of the show, Ireland, Australia, Japan, China, and now Mexico. Folks, I got the bill for the first half of this international expedition, and it was whopping. So I can only imagine what the bill is going to look like next month when we hear about the calls to China and Japan and Mexico. So it's also going to be whopping. So if you could help us out, that would be really, really appreciated. You know, as I say all the time on the program here, no donation is too small, and all donations go towards paying the bills at Banal of America and ensuring that the website is up and running, freely available, and commercial free for all of our great readers and listeners all over the world. On the next edition of the program, we already have a guest lined up. We already have a day lined up. We got a time lined up. But I'm just going to tease you and say that it'll be next Tuesday night, July 21st, same time, 8 p.m. It all worked out pretty well. And we'll announce the guest over the weekend. So I want to make sure it's absolutely locked in, but I'd say it's about 95%. So it's a good guest. It's a pretty well-known guest, and I think folks are really going to dig it. So that'll be on the next edition of the program, July 21st at 8 p.m. Check out Banal of America for more information. Also, BOA on Facebook. We'll roll out all the info in a few days. So stay tuned, as they say. And with all that said, thank you once again to Red Pill Junkie for coming on the show. I really do appreciate him giving us so much time and for his thoughtful insights into all this strange and unusual stuff that he has examined over the years. Thank you to all the BOA listeners, the folks listening right now, the hardcore listeners who tune in to the very end of the program. You are the best. Thank you for your enduring support of the program. You are the fuel that drives the Banal of America mothership. And I cannot thank you enough for everything, my friends. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.